This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A week after Senator John Kerry all but nailed down the Democratic presidential nomination, the gloves are coming off. Minutes after President Bush called to congratulate him on Super Tuesday, Senator Kerry described the president's foreign policy as arrogant and reckless. Later today, at an appearance in Texas, the president will remind voters that the senator who says there's not enough intelligence on terrorism introduced a bill to slash intelligence spending. According to NPR's most recent survey, terrorism and national security remain the second most important electoral issue in most Americans' minds, and Iraq isn't too far behind. So how are the Democrats and Republicans going to try to win on national security? Who owns this issue? A little later, we'll talk about how and when each party has had the upper hand on national security. We'll also speak with policy experts from both parties about when their candidates are doing well and what they could be doing better. If you're a Republican or a Democrat, what do you think is the best way for your party to play up its policy? If you're an independent, what will win your vote? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is White House correspondent for the New York Times, David Sanger. He's at his office here in Washington, where he's been writing about both the Kerry and the Bush camp's pitches on national security. Good to have you back on the program, David.
Always good to be here.
Yesterday, you wrote a piece for the paper that outlined Senator Kerry's national security message after an interview on the plane with him, including how he would have handled Haiti. And what did he have to say about that?
Well, this was interesting, Neil, because Senator Kerry made the argument to me that he would have first conducted preventative diplomacy to keep the situation from getting that bad. Nobody knows whether that, in fact, would have been possible. But secondly, that he would have sent U.S. troops in to protect President Aristide, who, of course, was escorted into exile by the United States after the Bush administration said they couldn't protect him. This has set up an interesting sort of sub-debate, separate and apart from the terrorism issues you raised, because the Bush administration argues that Aristide brought his problems upon himself, that he was sponsoring these gangs that were terrorizing many of the people in Haiti, and that even if he was freely elected, he had lost legitimacy. The senator said the opposite. He said, look, we get an elected leader, we can't pick and choose.
Even though he admitted that President Aristide had indeed been made some of his own problems.
He said he was no picnic.
But the overarching issue of democracy was more important, and that there was an implicit commitment to defend democracy in the New World, and that that had been abandoned by the Bush administration. Indeed, you paint a picture of a Democrat and a Democratic campaign with a very different worldview than that of the administration.
A quite different one, and I think you've seen that in Iraq, and I think your listeners probably understand the differences of their views there. But you even see them in areas like North Korea, where Senator Kerry said that he would negotiate directly with Kim Jong-il because he believes that in the end it's only the United States that can work out the deal that would disarm the North. Similarly, he disagreed with the administration's argument that the Iraq invasion had so intimidated other countries, including Libya, that it convinced Libya to give up its nuclear weapons. He said Libya was going to do that anyway.
And he notably ducked the question about Pakistan, which on the one hand you have Pakistan working as a nuclear proliferator, on the other hand a Pakistan that is critical to the war in Afghanistan and the war on terrorism.
Yeah, it's funny, Neil, you can't get either side, the president or Senator Kerry, to describe on the record exactly these painful trade-offs with Pakistan, because they can't afford to lose Musharraf, as we've discussed in previous shows. But on the other hand, they don't want to seem to be endorsing the proliferation that went on. And they're both sort of frozen in place about what they do on this case.
The issue of the Secretary of State was quite interesting. Senator Kerry described Colin Powell as a friend. He said he admired him, but he also said the Bush administration hadn't let him do his work.
That's right. In fact, at one point he said, you know, it's almost as if they'd kept the keys of his airplane away from him. I thought this was a very interesting approach, which was to try to separate out the Powell view of the world and associate. Senator Kerry was trying to associate himself more with Secretary Powell, and play up the split between Powell and the rest of the administration. I don't know how well that would sell, you know, around the country. Obviously, those of us who live here in Washington are quite aware of this division as one of the subtexts of covering the administration. I'm not sure whether in the rest of the United States that makes as big a difference.
The administration now has a president who's beginning to go into campaign mode himself and seems eager to engage on these issues.
Well, he does seem eager to engage. You played some examples of that, and I think you'll hear more of that in this debate over intelligence. So far, we haven't heard the president, though, sort of sit down and describe his views or his answers to some of what Senator Kerry has said in any great detail.
But he's certainly going to start engaging on it, and we've already had, and it seems pretty logical from everybody's point of view, the president would be focused on 9/11, terrorism, and of course, you also get interesting turns of phrase where Senator Kerry might say he's opposed to not necessarily the world is better off without Saddam Hussein, but the president has mishandled the war in Iraq, and the president says, well, that's not the war in Iraq, that's the liberation of Iraq.
That's right. Even the terminology becomes a subject of dispute. But what I think here is fascinating is, on the one hand, you have the first big debate during an election campaign over foreign policy and specifically national security policy, probably since the days of the Vietnam War. On the other hand, because there are not people in the streets the way they were in 1968 in that campaign, it is much more of a philosophical debate about how the United States should use this extraordinary unipolar moment of great power, and whether or not the president has increased that power by taking the steps he did in Afghanistan and Iraq, or whether or not by alienating allies he has in fact weakened the U.S. It's a very fundamental difference of view.
And we're going to be hearing it elucidated for the next 8 months. David Sanger, thanks very much for your time again.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for the New York Times, on the phone with us from his office here in Washington. Now, he mentioned the Vietnam War, a critical moment not only in this nation's history, but in the nation's political history as well. To talk about the parties which have the historical upper hand, joining us here in Studio 3A is Pat Tallow, a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He covered defense for Congressional Quarterly from 1975 until last year. It's good of you to come in, Pat Tallow.
Thanks, Neil. Glad to be here.
And again, the Vietnam War was a decisive break for the Democratic Party.
It really was. You remember that in the 1960 campaign, the Democratic nominee, John Kennedy, charged the Republican president with being soft on national defense. The Republican president was Dwight Eisenhower, the general who won the war. Hard to imagine his credentials being questioned, but that's how close the parties were. So the question is, how did one of the two national parties come to be fighting an uphill battle on this? And the taproot of it really is the civil war within the Democratic Party over the war in Vietnam. What came out of it was a built-in bias, a strong bias among active Democrats against unilateral U.S. action in global trouble spots, and a very strong bias against the use of military force. That was the substantive debate over Vietnam, but it took on political coloration because national Democratic leaders, presidential nominees, leading senators, and so forth, wound up in the public eye getting lumped together with people with a much broader agenda of opposition to the fundamental character of U.S. society. So that by 1972, I suspect that a lot of people saw the choice as not between Richard Nixon and George McGovern, who was a war hero. He was a bomber pilot over in World War II and so on. But rather, they saw a choice between Richard Nixon and Abby Hoffman. And it wasn't a close call in a lot of people's minds. Some of how did the party get smooshed in with a lot of radical activists? Some of it is the fault of the press. I mean, there are two and only two sides to every issue, and so you tend to lump people into pro and anti. But some of it, I think, was the Democrats' fault. They were unwilling to alienate any potential supporters, including people with whose agenda many of them did not agree, but they stuck themselves with it.
Interestingly, in that campaign, George McGovern elected not to use his war record, his distinguished war record as a bomber pilot during the Second World War. Interesting that Senator Kerry has made a different choice.
You're right. The only thing that McGovern exploited from his war record was he named his plane, his campaign plane, after the name of his bomber, Dakota Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Very different with Kerry. You go back to John Kennedy and PT-109. We'll see if we can get a movie actor as good as Cliff Robertson to make a movie as Robertson did about Kennedy's boat.
Well, I actually had occasion to see that picture not so long ago, and I don't recommend it. Anyway,
no.
it's interesting that then you get into the debate over the Reagan policy, where he was not one to advocate détente, but rather a rollback, a challenge to not only the Soviet Union, but to communism worldwide.
What happened once the issue got beyond the unique case of Vietnam, almost every other potential hotspot around the world you could imagine coming up in the 70s and 80s was seen by most Democrats through the prism of the U.S.-Soviet confrontation. And lurking in the background, somewhere back there, there was always the risk of the nuclear balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we push too hard, you know, does somebody do something reckless? And so what had become this bias, but it started as this bias against unilateral action and military force, became a very strong bias against calling the Soviets on anything. It reached a parity in the early and middle 80s. It was quite clear that the Soviets were violating various arms control agreements, the SALT II agreement and the anti-ballistic missile treaty. And you had very smart leading Democrats going through the most absurd verbal contortions to avoid saying that the Soviets had violated the treaty, because the fear of getting into a confrontation with them with nuclear weapons in the background was so grave. On the other side, you had the Republicans. They brought a number of things, advantages to the discussion. First of all, they were in tune with the country in terms of being willing to talk about America as being not just one other country. They were exceptionalist. They were willing to talk about us as being something special. They were willing to be assertive when people looked at the newscast and thought we're being pushed around. The Republicans were able to push back. And a very important thing that's easy to forget now, because it's 25 years since Ronald Reagan came on the national political scene. Voters in their late 30s were in their early teens. They barely remember. But they had in Ronald Reagan an almost preternaturally effective spokesman. Reagan had this remarkable gift for being comforting and reassuring, even as he was saying the most blood-curdling things about the Soviet state. And it didn't alarm people.
Let's get some callers involved in the discussion. 800-989-8255, and we'll begin with Victor, who's with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Victor.
Yes, I just want to make a statement. I have been confused for a long time that the Republicans always say that they are the ones who can defend the country, they are the ones who can protect us better than anybody else. But just look at history. It seems like World War One, World War Two, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, these were all Democrat presidents who got involved in it. So when the moment came, it was the Democratic government stood up to the challenge. And I think the Republicans get too much credit for doing that.
Victor has a point, doesn't he, Pat Towell?
It does indeed, and although you don't hear it very much anymore, for decades it was part of the congressional and Republican lexicon to talk about Democrat wars. As late as 1996, we had the Republican presidential candidate make that point.
Yet and Victor, by the way, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
With Ronald Reagan in office and then George Bush after him, the first George Bush, at the end of the Cold War, Republican resolution, correctly or incorrectly, and gets the credit for bringing down the Soviet Empire. Okay, we'll leave it at yes. Okay. We're going to continue our conversation when we come back from a short break. We're talking about national security and how it plays as a political issue this year. How would you like your party to present its argument over the next 8 months? If you're truly undecided, what would you like to hear on the issue of national security? Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Pat Towell will stay with us when we come back from the break. We'll be joined by advocates of both parties to tell us how they think their candidates are doing well and what they might be willing to do a little bit better. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about who owns the issue of national security, or rather, how both parties are trying to own it alone. You're invited to join our discussion. How important is national security to you this election year, and which party do you think delivers the stronger message? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN, at npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Republican Bill Kristol, but first we'll hear from a Democrat for an assessment on how his party is doing so far on this year in national security. William Galston is on the phone with us from the University of Maryland's campus in College Park, Maryland. There he's the director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Policy. He previously served as deputy assistant to President Clinton. Good to have you back on the program.
Good to be here, Neil.
So far, how do you think Senator Kerry in particular is doing with this issue on national security, traditionally a Democratic weakness?
I think Senator Kerry is doing quite well for a couple of reasons. First of all, he has the resume and the experience to be credible in the area of national security. I think the party felt that it was extremely important to find a nominee with those characteristics. Because if you don't have the resume, if you don't have the experience, I think there's no way of making up for that in a period in which the American people care a lot more about foreign policy than they did through the 1990s. Secondly, I think that Senator Kerry is beginning to fashion a pretty effective critique of the Bush administration's handling of foreign policy and defense. A critique focused on charges of unilateralism, arrogance, loss of credibility, overstretched goals and overstretched and misused armed forces, and inadequate focus on homeland security. Obviously, there's going to be a big debate about all of those points and many others that Senator Kerry is making, but he has some real ammunition, which I think is supported by some real doubts that many Americans have developed over the past year to 18 months about how the administration is conducting foreign policy. The third step, and I think Senator Kerry is beginning to do this, but more needs to be done, is to articulate a persuasive alternative to the Bush foreign and defense policy.
So you think he's got good offense and defense as well, but he's going to have to be playing a more tactical defensive game shortly as well when, as soon as later today, President Bush starts criticizing him. He's served as a member of the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee for many years. Yes, he has a lot of experience, but also a lot of votes against this defense system and that intelligence bill. And of course, most recently, the $87 billion program to fund the continuing reconstruction of Iraq.
Well, you don't have to have a very transparent crystal ball or a lot of experience with American politics to be able to guess what's going to happen in the next few months. The president's reelection campaign has about $150 million in the bank, and no doubt it is combing through the very, very long record of Senator Kerry in public life in search of points of what it regards as vulnerability. And I would expect a substantial portion of the next 3 months to be devoted to a steady drip, drip, drip of those items, perhaps even on a daily basis. A challenge facing the Kerry campaign will be to stay on the offense while mounting an effective defense. This is going to require a very high level of precision and self-knowledge on the part of the Kerry campaign. They will have to look at Senator Kerry's record and anticipate the most likely lines of criticism and be ready to counter them in the same news cycle.
Let's get some more callers involved in the conversation. Michael is with us from Anchorage, Alaska.
How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, I just want to make a statement about George Bush, President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not Republican or Democrat. Well, I am more Republican now. I'm in the military, and I wasn't before 9/11. But, I mean, you know, ever since 9/11, he's shown, like, an attitude and a moral backbone that I think that John Kerry or modern Democrats don't really have a history of showing. You know, he's shown how to lead the nation in time of crisis as well as lead the nation in foreign policy. And I don't think that that really happened with the Clinton administration, or I don't think John Kerry's record kind of reflects that.
William Galston, this is going to be, I think Michael has pointed out, one of the centerpieces of the campaign.
Absolutely. And the president is no doubt going to advertise what he regards as his steady leadership. And the question is whether steady movement in the wrong direction is what the American people are going to decide they want in the last analysis. And Senator Kerry can hardly say that President Bush is notorious for changing his mind. As a matter of fact, I would say the opposite is more nearly the case. He's well known for not changing his mind. And so the question is whether he's moving us in the right direction in the world. And Senator Kerry's challenge will be to persuade the American people that that is not the case and that he has a better idea.
Michael, is there anything that you could hear from Senator Kerry that might change your mind?
You know, I remember studying him when I was in college, you know, before he was a presidential candidate or anything, just hearing about the Vietnam record and stuff, and I respected that, and I thought that's really good that we have Vietnam veterans in political positions that can talk about things and govern our nation. But at the same time, I mean, he's characteristically changed his views on, like, intelligence funding or intelligence, whether it's worthwhile or not, and I think that's not what the nation needs. I think, like in the 30s with FDR and in the face of Nazi Germany, FDR was like a very, you know, strong person. He led the nation to victory. And I think the George Bush, you know, even though he's Republican, he has those same characteristics. And I think that's the difference. Not necessarily Republican or Democratic, but I think the moral characteristics of the individual is what's going to lead the nation. You know, this bipartisan stuff is an issue, but I mean, I understand too that, you know, I really think that George Bush really has more qualities of leadership and more qualities of foreign policy that America needs to go to than John Kerry. I don't think John Kerry really promotes the idea of, like, American superiority as far as, like, international terrorism or anti-terrorism or international, peacekeeping.
Okay,
you know,
Michael.
The 90s really kind of...
I think we got it, Michael. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
All right, bye.
And William Galston, I'd like to Pat Towell's ideas on this as well. One difference in the Kerry campaign has been the prominent, and Michael mentioned it, prominent role of veterans on the platform with him.
Yeah, particularly former Senator Max Cleland, former senator from Georgia, lost three limbs in Vietnam, had been associated with President Carter in Georgia, Veterans Affairs, and then with President Clinton before he went into the Senate. And you saw Cleland up there leading the charge. It was quite remarkable, and obviously resonated. One story I heard about the Kerry campaign in Iowa. Iowa is one of many states that has a tax break for veterans. And it's a public record.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody in the campaign last fall went out and found the 70 or 80,000 names of people who are veterans who get this tax break. By gosh, they worked them. They contacted them directly, and it's paid off. I mean, it's not just Cleland and a handful of others. I mean, people show up at every campaign stop. It's quite remarkable.
But William Galston, everyone will be quick to point out that Max Cleland lost his election, re-election campaign in Georgia on the issue of national security.
He sure did, and Senator Kerry is well aware of that history and is determined not to repeat it. Let me say one other thing about veterans in the Kerry campaign, or maybe two other things. First of all, those veterans have turned out to be the most persuasive character references by far for Senator Kerry. They have validated his possession of traits of character that Americans value in one another and which they certainly want in their leaders. And they've done it in a way that I think is pretty nearly unimpeachable.
And a lot of people would say tie the turnaround of the Kerry campaign to the moment when he welcomed the members of his old crew up onto the election campaign platform with him in Iowa.
Absolutely. And I might add that his visible sense of human connection with them helped Americans to break through the shell and see the real human being beneath the public exterior. The second point I want to make is that Senator Kerry clearly feels deeply that veterans deserve better treatment at the hands of their government than they've gotten in many cases. And I can tell you as a Vietnam-era veteran myself that the sense that veterans have that they have not been well used is pretty intense. And in the first Gulf War, for example, the exposure to toxic agents, which appear to have sickened a large number of them, is something they had to fight for recognition of those facts from the Department of Defense. I understand it's a complicated story, but this feeling that veterans have that they come home and they're not well treated is pretty pervasive, and I think Senator Kerry is tapping into that.
William Galston, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure thing.
William Galston, a professor at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland, former deputy assistant to President Clinton. He was with us by phone from Maryland's campus in College Park. And now on to the party who is in power now, the Republicans. With us is William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard. He's on the phone from his office here in Washington. Good to have you back on the program.
No, thanks. Good to be with you.
How can President Bush, by most polling statistics, he's got the advantage on national security. How does he hold on to it and build on it?
By having a successful national security policy over the next 7 or 8 months. You know, he's the incumbent president. You know, we're interested in all these abstract debates, but at the end of the day, he'll be judged by the success or failure of the bold and ambitious foreign policy he embraced after 9/11. And I think he has quite a lot of good news to point to. He has some problems to deal with. But I do think one should always remember that in a re-election, it's the record of the incumbent that's by far the most important thing.
We all remember, of course, 1992, when another President Bush had another successful war in Iraq and nevertheless lost re-election. Of course, the economy was the big issue that time, too. But I think this time around, national security will be a bigger secondary issue than it was in 1992.
Oh, I think national security will actually be a bigger issue than the economy this time, because we are, well, if it's not, I think Bush is in trouble, let me put it that way. In 92, circumstances and the ineptness of the first Bush White House allowed national security to drift down to a secondary or even tertiary issue. We had won the war in Iraq. Everything seemed fine. The Bush White House spent 1992, the first Bush White House, avoiding dealing with foreign policy problems, ranging from Somalia to the Balkans to Saddam remaining in power in Iraq, actually. Clinton was, you know, voters were reasonably able to think by November of 92, okay, the Cold War's over, Bush dealt with Saddam, and now let's have a president who focuses on education, health care, and the economy. I don't think that's really going to be possible this year. Everyone has a sense we're still engaged in a much broader struggle. But to the degree that the struggle seems over or seems lapsed, or to the degree Bush tries, in my view, to put foreign policy on hold and kick the can down the road, I think voters then might decide, well, Bush, Kerry, you know, they're both going to negotiate with the North Koreans. They're both going to negotiate with Iran. It's complicated. Who knows who really did? There's not much difference. That's bad for Bush. But then you do get a health care, education, jobs election. So I don't think Bush thinks that's the way the world is. You know, he thinks we're still at war. He needs to persuade his fellow Americans that that's the case.
How important, this is an email question from Matt Teff in Coon Rapids, Minnesota, how important will the fact that Senator Kerry has actually seen combat on a battlefield play into his ability to convince people he can be trusted with national security? A couple of my family members in the National Guard have said Kerry's nomination makes them feel safe voting for a Democrat.
Well, if his family members are saying that, then he's got some empirical evidence that that's the case. I would say this, and I heard your previous discussion with Bill and Pat.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the exit polls carefully in all the many of the Democratic primaries. Kerry did not run better among veterans than among the population as a whole, nor did he run better among family members of veterans, either, I believe, Vietnam vets or certainly veterans as a whole. I was for McCain in 2000. He thought veterans would help him in South Carolina, has the highest concentration of veterans. He lost South Carolina. He won New Hampshire, where there were fewer veterans. I'm a little dubious about the notion that people will vote for the next president based on the admittedly admirable performance of Kerry 32 years ago, 35 years ago, I guess, or the admittedly perhaps, you know, sort of murky performance of Bush, for that matter, in the National Guard 32 years ago. It just, you know, it's the re-election of a president in 2004. People are perfectly capable of saying, you know what, we honor John Kerry for his service in Vietnam, but we don't agree with him on foreign policy. So going forward. So I'm a little dubious about all the Vietnam talk. I think we're all interested in it. It's our generation. It's an interesting, we all remember those, I shouldn't speak for you, but people like my age and certainly a little older, like Bill Galston.
I remember them too.
I remember those debates so well, but I'm not sure that most voters are really going to make it. I don't think many voters at all, in fact, are going to make much of a decision based on that.
We're speaking about who owns this issue, national security, with William Crystal of the Weekly Standard and Pat Towell of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the phone. And this is Peter, who's with us from Washington, D.C.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I find it very hard to understand the dominance of the right or the perceived dominance of the right on national security issues, because I understand the right to have made a long series of strategic and nearly disastrous errors on national security issues. And the intelligence misstating and misunderstandings in Iraq are part of that long pattern. I see Vietnam as, you know, having been the result of a dramatic misunderstanding of what was really going on in Vietnam, basically a national civil war perceived as a part of the global Cold War. I see the whole military buildup in the 1980s as an attempt to bring down the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union was already in the process of collapse, and there was a vast overstatement of the Soviet threat by the CIA, and complete misunderstanding of what was going on. And Iraq is part of this pattern of vastly overstating the military threats from abroad, and it's part of a pattern of excessive militarism, of, you know, seeing these, you know, everything is a threat to the military dominance of the United States and a need for the United States to dominate militarily. And this has led to this long series of errors, you know, just errors.
Well, let's get a response from William Crystal, admitting that Vietnam was certainly a bipartisan mistake. But go ahead, William Crystal.
Well, look, I think the caller eloquently, you know, states one point of view. It's not one I agree with, and I think the counterargument would be obviously, you know, with the problem in our dealing with terrorism over the last decade, that we were too prone to use military force, or too reluctant. Were we too fast to go into Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, or too slow? Were we too fast to intervene in the Balkans? What about Rwanda, for that matter? It seems to me the story of the 90s, the post-Cold War years, is a story of excessive timidity, in my view, in the use of force, and in general, in sort of American intervention around the world. We could debate the Reagan buildup and the Soviet Union, I suppose, for ages, but I'll leave that aside. I would say on Iraq, look, it is a fair point to say that we have not found weapons of mass destruction, and that people like me certainly expected us to, and voters will have to judge how much they want to sort of penalize President Bush for that miscalculation. On the other hand, the question for Kerry is obviously going to be, and there's a pretty revealing interview in Time magazine that's out today, in which Kerry just does not take either side in this position. Well, okay, fine. Knowing what we know now, was the war in Iraq justified? Kerry will not say that it was not, but he won't quite say that it was. He'll talk about how he would have done it differently. But at the end of the day, Saddam is gone. We're engaged in a difficult reconstruction that seems to be going pretty well, though, I think, in certain ways. The Middle East, I think, is being transformed for the better. Others can quarrel with that. But I think that will be the fundamental judgment people will make. I mean, Bush made mistakes. Not everything went well. But ultimately, was it the right thing to do to go to remove Saddam or not? And I think one challenge for Kerry, and I really don't say this in a partisan spirit, I think it's an honest, you know, comment, is that it's just not clear. Ultimately, what is he going to say in the debate with Bush in October? That you were wrong to go to war in Iraq, or that you were right to go to war, but you did it in the wrong way?
William Crystal, thanks very much.
Thank you.
William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, joined us by phone from his office here in Washington. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue this conversation and we'll find out more about that reconstruction effort in Iraq as a provisional constitution is approved today and then criticized. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing how national security is playing out as an issue on the campaign trail. Pat Towle is still with us here in Studio 3A, currently a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And Pat, as you listen to what William Galston and Bill Crystal had to say, how do their positions and the way the parties are going compare with previous incarnations, the historical representations of each party?
The image that Galston sketches, and that the Democratic Leadership Council that he was associated with, mm-hmm. Bill Clinton and Joe Lieberman, that's really an attempt to sort of get beyond Vietnam, go back to the Kennedy or the Scoop Jackson, the senator from Washington State, who was the leading spokesman for the party up until Vietnam, when he wound up on what became the losing side.
Within his party.
A couple things went on in the course of concurrently with the schism over Vietnam within the Democratic Party. One was that there was a change in the electoral dynamic within the party, partly because of the fight over Vietnam. Power in the presidential nominating process shifted from national party leaders who looked to win and therefore tended toward the center, to grassroots activists who were frosted that they'd been shut out by the Johnson administration and so on. And the, it's axiomatic that activists and the two parties tend toward the ideological poles. So the nominating process sort of drifted left within the Democratic Party. And secondly, there was a generational...
And fair to say to the right and the
and
Republican
to the right,
Party,
to
too.
Be sure, to be sure. The other thing that happened was a change in the composition of the base, the base groups of the Democratic constituency. The generation of labor leaders, organized labor leaders typified by George Meany at the AFL-CIO, the generation who fought the wars against the communists in the 30s, that generation died out. Organized labor had been a big, you know, hardline, you know, Cold War liberal force within the Democratic Party, and the organized labor movement changed. It was a generational change. The other thing was that a group that had not really been on the powerful political in the political constellation, African Americans came into the voting force, and African American leaders were more focused on domestic interests, and that tended to push. And when you had a guns versus butter debate, that pushed the Democrats. You know, if you have to make a choice, we'll choose for the butter, and that means you wind up voting against guns.
Hmm. Now, Hispanics, of course, was, becoming even a bigger force, larger certainly in numbers. Mm-hmm. Email question from Claire in Kansas City. I don't think either party owns the issue of foreign policy. No matter who is in office, the world will find reasons to complain. Who knows how the Democrats would have handled the issues at hand right now in the presidential race, because the Republicans are the ones receiving the criticism. The Democrats may have an upper hand on this policy. If Democrats were in office right now, I'm sure they would be in the same shoes. I don't think experience is always the winning point. And that...
Yeah, I agree with her in that if you're the president, you've got to deal with the issues as they arise. You can't control your own agenda. You can't stay, you know, stay on message all the time. The world imposes itself. In some degree, the President Bush has created a potential trap for himself by setting this July 1 date for handing over sovereignty, whatever that means, to Iraq. I get the sense that there's a very, very strong interest within the administration in reducing the day-to-day engagement of U.S. forces on the ground over in Iraq in this incessant drumfire guerrilla warfare. Getting them out of these day-to-day engagement and, you know, mm-hmm. driving by the car bombs and all that, two or three kids get killed a week. If, in the context of, quote, handing over sovereignty, unquote, to whatever passes for the government of Iraq, if the U.S. forces on the ground become sufficiently inactive that things start to go to the devil over there, so that we get into the fall and maybe no U.S. soldiers are getting killed, but the situation in the country is clearly going to hell in a handbag, the Kerry line, I assume, is our troops fought the good fight, they acted bravely, courageously, brilliantly, and then these civilian politicians in the Bush White House screwed it all up. Look, it's all falling apart.
On the other hand, if it goes reasonably
well,
perhaps they find Osama bin Laden, then this can play to the president's benefit as well.
Look at the bounce that that the president got when they found Saddam.
Thanks very much for being with us today. Pat Towle is a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He covered defense at Congressional Quarterly for more than 25 years. He joined us here in Studio 3A.